Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ira Melman. Russia says it's ready to discuss a ceasefire in Syria. Russian spokesman made that comment as foreign ministers gather in Munich to seek an end to a bloody civil war that has devastated the Arab country. The U.S., Russia, and other members of the 17-nation International Syria Support Group are holding a series of talks in Germany on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference. A focal point for the group is the Russian proposal for a ceasefire in Syria, where a Russian-backed Syrian offensive in Aleppo has worsened the humanitarian crisis by forcing thousands of civilians to flee toward the Turkish border. State Department spokesman Mark Toner said he was not aware of a specific date for the Russian proposal, but stressed, "I think our preference would be for an immediate ceasefire."
It's very clear what needs to get done. There needs to be action in accordance with the UN Security Council Resolution 2254, which calls for a move towards full and immediate humanitarian access and a full ceasefire. Again, there have been multiple conversations over the past week between Secretary Kerry and Foreign Minister Lavrov. We've been expressing our concerns, frankly, about some of the actions in and around Aleppo, which has only complicated the situation on the ground in Syria.
A Turkish official told VOA that Russia might be putting forward a ceasefire plan now because it had completed a phase of their military operations in Aleppo. NATO was sending warships to the Aegean Sea to target migrant smugglers in the alliance's most direct intervention in the wave of people trying to reach European shores. The NATO mission was put in motion Thursday following backing from U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter. This is VOA. A new United Nations report finds that climate change and El Nino had a strong influence on natural disasters in 2015. It says these phenomena affected both the number and intensity of droughts, floods, and other weather-related hazards around the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction says 32 major droughts were recorded in 2015. This is more than double the 10-year annual average. The impact was particularly serious in sub-Saharan Africa. The Belgian-based Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters compiles the data on earthquakes, drought, floods, cyclones, and other global natural disasters. After reviewing the data, the center's director, Deborati Guha-Sapir, declares 2015 to be the year of the drought.
Over 50 million people are now affected. This will get worse in 2016.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A brutal fight between rival factions has killed 52 inmates and injured 12 at a prison in northern Mexico this day. Nuevo León Governor Jaime Rodriguez said there were no reported escapes, and the battle, which sent flames billowing into the pre-dawn sky, did not involve guns. The country's deadliest prison riot in many years broke out just 6 days before Pope Francis is scheduled to visit another Mexican prison in the border city of Ciudad Juarez in Chihuahua State. The U.S. presidential race is moving to the southern state of South Carolina, where Democratic Senator Bernie Sanders is hoping to build on the momentum from his landslide victory in New Hampshire earlier in the week. Appearing on a U.S. talk show Wednesday on the CBS television network, Sanders explained why his message is resonating with young voters.
By definition, young people are idealistic, and they look at a world with so many problems, and they say, why not? Why can't all people in this country have health care? Why can't we make public colleges and universities tuition-free? Why not?
Sanders hopes to improve his position among minorities in South Carolina, where early polls have him trailing Hillary Clinton, who hopes to improve her standing with younger voters. On the Republican side, Donald Trump is hoping to repeat his victory in New Hampshire with a win in South Carolina, where voters head to the polls in 9 days. Trump will have less competition, with two Republican contenders dropping out of the race on Wednesday. North Korea says South Korea's decision to suspend operations at a jointly run industrial complex amounts to a declaration of war. North ordered all South Korean nationals to leave the complex and it was seizing all materials left behind. I'm Ira Mill.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Ruhib coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Zimbabwe's government this week launched a $1.5 billion international appeal for assistance to avert hunger. But some parts of the country are already feeling the pinch of the El Nino weather phenomenon.
There's Sebastian Monfou reporting from Harare. Details coming up.
Also, more than 60 displaced Nigerians died after suicide bombs exploded in a remote camp in the north. And NATO Supreme Commander in Europe orders 3 warships into the Aegean to stop the smuggling of migrants and refugees from Turkey to Greece.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Benin, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Zimbabwe's government this week launched a $1.5 billion international appeal for assistance to avert hunger. But some parts of the country are already feeling the pinch of the El Nino weather phenomenon. Sebastian Mofu has been to some of the hardest hit areas and reports from Harare.
Chivi District in Mashingo Province, about 350 kilometers south of Harare, is one of the areas hard hit by hunger in Zimbabwe. Here in Madzivadondo village, the land is dry. Nothing is green. There are no crops, although it is supposed to be the growing season. Cattle and other domestic animals, those still alive, look hungry and hopeless as the villagers. 85-year-old Ramek Madzivadondo says he has never seen things this bad. He says there used to be hunger, but never like this. He says his cattle have all died and there is nowhere around where there is hope. People are suffering. There is nothing to eat, he says. There is nothing. Zimbabwe Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa says there are actually 3 million people in Madzivadondo's predicament, going for days without anything to eat. Zimbabwe's appeal was made to the United Nations and other international organizations such as USAID. Bisho Parajuli, the UN resident coordinator in Zimbabwe, said the world body was already providing aid before the latest appeal came in.
So far, about 60 million was mobilized. Close to a million people are being reached with food support. Now, given the new challenge in terms of doubling of this affected population, the need is almost doubled. So we really need to revamp. Sadly, the situation is bad in the whole continent. Recently, Ethiopia came in a big way saying that they have over 10 million people affected.
According to the Famine Early Warning Systems Network, a provider of early warning and analysis on food insecurity, El Nino has led to drier than average conditions in some parts of the Horn of Africa, such as Ethiopia and in Southern Africa, affecting countries like Zimbabwe, Malawi, Lesotho, Zambia, Swaziland, South Africa, and Mozambique. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
More than 60 displaced Nigerians died after suicide bombs exploded in the middle of the night on Tuesday in a remote camp in the north. Emergency services service officials say 78 others were injured. Camp officials welcomed 3 young girls who asked to spend the night, but 2 of the girls detonated their bombs during the night. The third girl turned herself into authorities after she saw her parents and siblings living in the camp. Officials say the girl surrendered to authorities and warned that future attacks were being planned at the Dikwa camp. Meanwhile, in neighboring Cameroon, officials say 10 died when a suicide bomber attacked people gathering for a wake in a village in the far north of the country.
A NATO Supreme Commander in Europe, General Philip Breedlove, has ordered three warships into the Aegean. They've been sent to stop the smuggling of migrants and refugees from Turkey to Greece. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg says warships from Germany, Turkey, and Canada will be under German command. They'll conduct reconnaissance and surveillance to prevent illegal trafficking to Europe. More than 800,000 migrants and refugees have made the dangerous crossing in the last 14 months. Stoltenberg says the ships were ordered to move immediately to help Greece, Turkey, and the EU cope with human tragedy. They will provide information about illegal trafficking to local officials, but will not stop or push back boats carrying migrants. Stoltenberg said NATO is also discussing ways to help patrol the Turkish-Syrian border.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan today has confirmed local reporting that last year he threatened to bus migrants to Europe during negotiations with EU officials. The EU later offered Turkey $3.4 billion to take care of Syrian refugees. The German government has agreed to let some families of unaccompanied child refugees to join their children. The decision came weeks after the government vowed to restrict future migration of families of recently arrived refugees.
More than 1 million migrants and refugees traveled to Europe last year, and thousands of others died making the journey. It's the largest movement of migrants and refugees into Europe since World War II. Britain's Overseas Development Institute has released a report on whether government decisions to block or restrict such movements are actually deterrent. VOA's Joe DiCapua has the story.
The ODI policy brief, Journeys to Europe, is based on in-depth interviews with more than 50 migrants, refugees, and asylum seekers in Britain, Germany, and Spain. Research fellow Jessica Hackenzanker is co-author. She says to best deal with the crisis, officials must understand the mindset of those making the journey.
European politicians, and actually politicians all over the world, are making these huge assumptions that refugees, asylum seekers, but also other, you know, economic migrants are coming to Europe because they're being pulled by migration policies. So policymakers think that people are coming because policies are making it easier for them to come. And we wanted to test whether these policies change people's minds about migration.
The ODI policy brief says, with some exceptions, the European response has been guided by strategies of containment, restriction, and deterrence. It adds that rather than welcoming, settling, and integrating the new arrivals, many EU member states have tried to drive them away through restrictive migration policies designed to stop people coming in the first place.
These policies, these deterrent policies, can work by keeping people out of countries, physically keeping them out. For example, building a fence means people cannot get across the border anymore. Having very strict visa regulations means people can't get on a plane and come to those countries. But policymakers also assume that these policies work before people even set out on the journey, and they assume that these policies change people's minds about migration.
Hackenzanker says one key finding is that the journey itself influences the migration decision-making process. She and co-author Richard Mallett write that people's plans change along the way.
Many of these journeys are very expensive, long, dangerous, and unpredictable. And this means that migrants need to adapt their plans to what is happening to them along the way. So they receive new information, they meet new people, they have good and bad experiences. Maybe someone helps them, but maybe someone also rips them off. And all of that influences what migrants do next.
Another finding is that precarious journeys are often the norm. Nearly 4,000 migrants and refugees died last year in boat tragedies on the Mediterranean and Aegean.
We talked to migrants coming from three different groups, Eritreans, Senegalese, and Syrians. On average, these people spent almost £3,000 trying to reach Europe, so that's very expensive if you compare that to what it would cost to get on a plane. About a third of our respondents were extorted in some way almost half of our Eritrean respondents were kidnapped for ransom at one point during the journey.
A third key finding is that anti-migration messages from European governments are not likely to deter people's decisions.
So the people that are coming to Europe have made the decision to come because they feel they have no choice.
The Overseas Development Institute policy brief says migrants and refugees are thinking long term. What's best for their children? Can they rebuild their lives? Can they find jobs?
Those kind of more general public policies seem to influence people much more than migration policies.
The policy brief makes three recommendations. The first calls for making the journeys easier by dealing with what it calls the appalling humanitarian and economic consequences of policies that aim to deter migration. It says this can be done by expanding search and rescue missions on the Mediterranean and Aegean and offering humanitarian visas to allow easier legal entry into Europe. ODI also calls on the EU to establish a system to quickly process requests from asylum seekers and then share responsibility for taking them in. It says Europe needs to take advantage of the social and economic benefits that migration can bring. Finally, it calls on European countries to take a unified regional approach to the crisis, rather than having individual countries set varying and conflicting policies. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The Associated Press reports that the African Union peacekeeping force in Somalia says Al-Shabaab militants are planning to conduct future raids disguised as peacekeepers. The African Union mission to Somalia, AMISOM, issued the warning in a tweet from its website yesterday. AMISOM officers say the fighters, who are linked to Al-Qaeda, have stolen peacekeeper uniforms in recent raids. They say the militants are planning to masquerade as AMISOM forces in coming attacks. AMISOM suffered heavy losses of Kenyan forces when Al-Shabaab launched a dawn raid on the El Ad training camp on January 15th. The militants claim they killed more than 100 soldiers at the base. Nairobi has not released an official death count.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 18 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. More than 60 displaced Nigerians died after suicide bombs exploded in a remote camp in the north. And NATO's supreme commander in Europe has ordered three warships in the Aegean to stop the smuggling of migrants and refugees from Turkey to Greece. And would like to hear your thoughts and our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237.
A report in the New England Journal of Medicine presents new evidence strengthening the link between the Zika virus and an increase in certain birth defects. The report, published by a group of Slovenian researchers, was accompanied by an editorial by a group of U.S. health experts who support the conclusions made by the Slovenian study. The study centered on an expectant mother who was infected with the Zika virus. She aborted the fetus after an ultrasound showed signs of severe fetal abnormalities.
Brazil is at the center of the Zika virus outbreak. The country has seen a rise in cases of microcephaly or underdeveloped brains in newborns that coincides with the rise in Zika virus infections. The prevalence of the disease carrying mosquitoes has some health experts recommending pregnant women or women trying to get pregnant avoid travel to Brazil. Brazil is preparing to host the 2016 Summer Olympic Games. U.S. public health officials testifying before congressional committees yesterday said much of the anti-Zika effort must focus on mosquito control.
Well, Well, wars, conflicts, poverty, and extreme weather conditions cause global markets to fluctuate from one extreme to another, causing investors to be on edge. However, during times of uncertainty, developing economies can offer rewards. Much of Africa is made up of emerging economies and countries rich in resources and potential opportunities for investors. Gavin Wilson is the CEO of the Washington-based IFC Asset Management Company, a member of the World Bank Group. He spoke with me about the opportunities and challenges Africa faces as it strives to become an economic leader on the global stage.
So clearly the world has changed in the last year or two. What we had been seeing over the last few years is a steady capital inflow into developing markets across a broad range of sectors. And in the last year, we've seen a very large net capital outflow. So as a result, those investors who are still investing in emerging and developing economies are becoming a little bit more selective in terms of which sectors they're focused on. Infrastructure, obviously, continues to be an extremely important sector. There are a lot of opportunities there, particularly in terms of transportation and power. We're also seeing in some economies, the ones that are still growing quickly, an emerging consumer sector. So a broad range of consumer goods industries are growing quite quickly, need capital, and are attracting investment from the outside. Then, of course, it depends very much country by country, but energy continues to be an important sector for a number of countries.
What would you say would be some of the challenges with the falling oil prices?
It's always a little bit of an anomaly when you have sharp changes in commodity prices, because you would assume that for every country that suffers as a result of the price of oil going down, there's another economy that benefits because it's an oil importer. But it always seems that the pain is felt more strongly than the gain. In the case of Nigeria, as an oil exporter, clearly the lower oil price is a problem, particularly for government finances. Budget deficit has gone up. Having said that, we do see Nigeria continuing to grow. We forecast the growth will grow from about 3.3% last year up to about 4.6% during this year, 2016. And, you know, that is driven by the power sector, that's driven by an emerging consumer class and by infrastructure more broadly. So in some ways, Nigeria epitomizes the whole continent. It's not only the largest economy, but it has a relatively diverse group of sectors and will continue to attract capital, but they do have some macro challenges now as a result of the oil price falling.
What are some other sectors in Africa that the world should be focused on?
Coming out of Paris and the COP21 accord, I think we are seeing very clearly a global trend towards renewable energy. This is not just an Africa story, but it is definitely including an Africa story in the sense that one of the biggest bottlenecks to growth in Africa is the supply of power. And there are traditional ways of doing that, and there are newer renewable ways of doing that. And so we are very active in both wind and solar. And this is not going to supplant existing fossil fuels overnight, but a large part of the new installed power capacity in Africa is coming in these renewable sectors.
What are some initiatives that came out of the World Economic Forum that you think should be put into place that will help emerging economies?
One of the themes at Davos this year was the fact that we now have the Sustainable Development Goals. We all signed up to those in September at the UN summit. And the focus now is very much on how do we actually operationalize or implement or finance these SDGs. So I participated in a number of discussions on how we finance these goals. And one of the emerging things that I see, which is very encouraging, is increasing focus on blended finance. And I mean that in a way that is distinct from the traditional public-private partnership approach. Blended finance is where you have different types of capital from both public and private sources sort of jointly financing projects together and sharing risk, not trying to kind of divvy risk up in a very sort of legalistic way, but actually having aligned incentives and making sure that the official assistance, which does still exist but is not growing enormously, can be leveraged as much as possible with private capital.
Also, many economists are predicting a slowdown in economic growth in the coming months and years ahead. So how can developing economies capitalize on this? And also, do you agree with this prediction?
Well, growth slowed in 2015. I think the consensus view is that it will be a little bit higher in 2016. I think generally these forecasts tend to be more optimistic than pessimistic. I have to say that when you look historically at what typically happens in these situations, we've been at this now, IFC is celebrating its 60th anniversary this year, and one of the things we've learned is that the best time to invest is precisely when everyone else is leaving. But our objective is not simply to time our investments, but also to generate as much capital as possible toward growth in the developing world, particularly in Africa. And it worries us when we see other capital providers heading for the exit door.
Gavin Wilson is the CEO of the Washington-based IFC Asset Management Company. He spoke with me from Washington.
A new United Nations report finds that climate change and El Niño had a strong influence on natural disasters in 2015. It says this phenomenon affected both the number and intensity of droughts, floods, and other weather-related hazards around the world. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Office for Disaster Risk Reduction says 32 major droughts were recorded in 2015. This is more than double the 10-year annual average. The impact was particularly serious in sub-Saharan Africa. The Belgian-based Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters compiles the data on earthquakes, drought, floods, cyclones, and other global natural disasters. After reviewing the data, the center's director, Deborati Guha-Sapir, declares 2015 to be the year of the drought.
Over 50 million people are now affected. This will get worse in 2016. We are going to face a humanitarian disaster in 2016, and there will be a movement of population and migration.
Africa last encountered severe drought in 2011, when a lack of rain in the Horn of Africa displaced about 12 million from their homes and killed an estimated 260,000 people in Somalia. Guha-Sapir warns droughts are the disasters that have the most persistent impact on human development.
Droughts lead to severe malnutrition in small children, and severe malnutrition of small children lead to their deaths within 4 to 6 weeks.
Guha-Sapir says there were early warnings of the disaster in 2011, but governments did not pay attention. She says governments should not repeat that mistake now and wait for the United Nations to declare a famine before taking action. She warns once a famine is declared, it will be too late to turn the disaster around. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the Uganda presidential elections with Shaka Sali in Uganda and me, Esther Gidu Yuart, as the studio guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk, rumors. Millions are paid to athletes, singers, and actors for their work. Celebrities, do they earn too much money? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing rumors. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Zimbabwe's government this week launched a $1.5 billion international appeal for assistance to avert hunger. And a report in the New England Journal of Medicine presents new evidence strengthening the link between the Zika virus and an increase in certain birth defects. Coming up, music from Benin, and in our feature segment, a two-way interactive distance teacher training program. It's launched in Ghana. I'm Kim Lewis with the Hayes Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you're beginning with boxing.
Kim, it's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta. Good evening, Nnamdi.
And a good evening, Sunny.
Amir Khan versus Saul Canelo Alvarez, May 7th in Las Vegas, Nevada. Your reaction, Nnamdi?
Well, I thought it was a joke because Amir Khan is not a middleweight. Amir Khan is what we call a welterweight, which is 147 pounds. So Amir Khan is jumping like two weight classes to meet the Mexican pit bull Canelo.
At what weight will this fight be at?
Well, the middleweight weight class is 160 pounds. But for this fight, there's a special weight class, which is called the catch weight. The both sides agreed to do a catch weight fight.
What is that catch weight?
Catch weight is when the both fighters decides to go and do a private contract. So both agreed that, okay, we will not go above this limit. If you go above this limit, you'll be fined. So the both sides agree, okay, we'll do it at 155, less than 5 pounds, less than the middleweight class, which is the 160 pounds.
What about after the weigh-in, Nnamdi? Can't each fighter put on a lot of weight, like water weight?
This is where the fans were just like surprised that there's no rehydration clause in this contract. Rehydration clause means that you cannot go above certain weight after the weigh-in. Mind you, the weigh-in, the fight is on Saturday night. The weigh-in is Friday afternoon. So come fight night, which is Saturday night, Canelo can balloon from 155 pounds to 185. And the most Khan can do will be like 168. So Canelo will be much bigger, way bigger than Khan, and a disadvantage for Khan.
It sounds like Khan can win only through his speed and maybe on points, Nnamdi, that he's not going to really be able to hurt Canelo.
Amir Khan does not have the power to knock out Canelo. Amir Khan is a welterweight who has no power. So all he can do is tick and move, run, hold, tie up Canelo. Basically, he needs, apart from a strength coach in his camp, he needs a ballet coach. So he can be able to slide and move, because if he makes the mistake, one silly mistake of standing to go toe-to-toe with Canelo, he will be knocked out and he may end up in the ICU.
Let's talk venue, Nnamdi. Where is this fight going to take place?
This fight will open the brand new venue at the MGM Grand Casino. It's called the T-Mobile Arena. The T-Mobile Arena is 22,000 people strong. So we're looking at a live gate that will bring close to $18 million, Sunny. So everybody would like to go into this brand new arena May 7th, and it's a big weekend for Latino boxing fans, Cinco de Mayo, so look for a sellout and a big, huge live gate.
Nnamdi, I remember you telling our VOA boxing fans that you thought Mayweather would open this new arena. Has there been any reaction from Mayweather about Khan Canelo?
Well, Mayweather is always sitting and watching what's going to happen. He wants, he's waiting to see who will come out on top. If Canelo loses to Amir Khan, expect Mayweather to come out for number 50 against Amir Khan. You know, this is boxing. This is not wrestling. It's not scripted like wrestling. Anything can happen. Amir Khan can come and make Canelo look stupid. Go back and look at the fight between Mayweather and Canelo. America may get a blueprint from that fight and beat Canelo easy on May 7th. It can happen.
Let's talk about the pay-per-view numbers, Namdi Khan. He's got this Arab heritage in his family, Canelo, the pride of Mexico. What are we looking at for possible pay-per-view numbers?
Sonny, we're looking at good numbers. When we talk about good numbers, we're looking at a fight that could bring in close to $100 million. American is a British-Pakistani. He's going to bring in a lot from the Arab world. We're talking about UAE, United Arab Republic, United Arab Emirates. We're looking at Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Bahrain, all these countries. Big rollers coming in for this fight. Then you throw in your Pakistan, you throw in your India and the whole of Europe. Plus the US with Canelo and Mexico and all that, 100 million plus. And the life gate and the what we call the closed circuit, it's a huge fight, Sonny.
Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moueta. Joining us once again on the sunny side of sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sonny.
In African club football, David, preliminary round, first leg action coming up in the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup tournaments. Let's begin with the Champions League, David. And how about a preview?
Right, Sonny. And on Friday, we have a couple of matches to get the ball rolling, so to speak. And one of the first fixtures is also, I think, one of the most attractive, potentially, of the weekend. It's Vipers Sports Club of Uganda making their debut up against Enyimba of Nigeria. Enyimba, winners of the title in 2003 and again in 2004. The only Nigerian club to win the CAF Champions League. Enyimba did not do well last year, Sonny. Went out of the last 32 stage. And it's going to be a tough one, particularly this first leg in Kampala. And it'll be interesting to see if Vipers field Farouk Maya. He is, of course, the young star of the Ugandan national team. He had an unfortunate chance in the sense that he was injured in the first game, missed the second game, and was well policed in the third game. So he didn't make quite the impression that we were all expecting. But nevertheless, he's a consistent goal scorer. He operates from the left wing. He's only 18 years of age. And provided he can agree personal terms, he will be off shortly to Belgium to play for Standard Liège. But if he does play, Enyimba would be well advised to pay a lot of attention to him. That match is on Friday afternoon in Kampala. And then when we move on to Saturday, young Africans of Tanzania, who are regular campaigners in Africa, but don't really make a great impression, they're in Mauritius to play Circle Joachim. Zesco United of Zambia, they're at home to Al Ghazal of South Sudan. And then another very attractive pairing, a Southern African derby, so to speak, is Chicken Inn of Zimbabwe, another debutant, against Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa. Now, Sundowns at the moment, 6 points ahead in the South African Premiership, looking very impressive indeed. And interestingly, one of the stars of their team is a Zimbabwean. It's Kama Biliat, diminutive player, very creative, scores a lot of goals. And he's sure to get a hot reception in Lubevi Stadium in Bulawayo, which is the second city in Zimbabwe. The Zimbabwean teams, generally, Sonny, they raise their game when they come up against opposition from South Africa. And this would be a really tough one for Sundowns and an interesting early test of their credentials, because they're hyper-ambitious and they want nothing less than to actually win the CAF Champions League. Over in East Africa on Saturday, Gor Mahia of Kenya, they play Knaps Sport of Madagascar. Now, that is a replay of a preliminary round match of last year, and it was a really close call, with Gor winning 1-0 in Nairobi, losing 3-2 on the huge island of Madagascar, and the Kenyans squeezing through on the away goal rule. On to Sunday, and the second South African challengers, Kaizer Chiefs, they're up against a Falcon Club in the Comores. Over to West Africa, we've got Ashanti Gold of Ghana playing host to Mouloudia Bejaia of Algeria. And that is going to be a tough one for Ashanti Gold, who back in 1997, when the CAF Champions League was launched, They were the runners-up to Raja Casablanca of Morocco. The second Nigerian representatives, Wari Wolves, they've got plenty of African experience in the CAF Confederation Cup, but this is their debut in the Champions League. And they've got a fairly straightforward task. They're up against a team called Club Sporting Praia Cruz from Sao Tome e Principe. Now, Sao Tome e Principe, one of the weaker African football nations, and I would expect Wally Wolves to win that game by 2-3 or possibly even more goals. Certainly, anything other than a convincing victory for Wally Wolves would be a surprise there. We should also wish well, Sonny, Nimba United. They're another debutant club. They're from Liberia, and they're up against the 1979 champions, Union Douala of Cameroon. That match is in Monrovia on Sunday afternoon.
Thanks for that CAF Champions League preview, David. That's David Legg, our African football guru, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa.
They're playing back.
The National Basketball Association will hold its 65th annual All-Star Game on Sunday in Toronto, Canada. It marks the first time the popular exhibition contest has been held outside the United States. The game will be played at Air Canada Center, the home arena of the NBA's Toronto Raptors Club. The Raptors had two players selected for the All-Star Game, guards Kyle Lowry and DeMar DeRozan, and I expect both players will hear a few cheers from the partisan crowd in Toronto. The reigning NBA champion Golden State Warriors are the only club with three players selected for the All-Star Game: guard Klay Thompson, forward Draymond Green, and sharpshooter Stephen Curry, the league's current MVP and leading scorer. And while Curry should get a lot of attention in Toronto, so will Los Angeles Lakers superstar Kobe Bryant, who announced this season his 20th in the NBA will be his last. Kobe received almost 1.9 million votes in fan balloting for the All-Star Game. That's the most by any player, and Kobe will start for the Western Conference All-Stars. I encourage our VOA listeners to check out my latest Sunny Side of Sports blog post, which is on the NBA's 65th All-Star Game in Toronto. The address is blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Once again, that address, blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. Tweet, 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 right, Kim Lewis? I'm VOA Sunny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Matthew Yeheyes Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
All righty, tweet, tweet. Thank you, Sunny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, a two-way interactive distance teacher training program launched in Ghana. And next, the booming housing market in Nairobi. But first, some music. Here is Angelica Kijo from Benin with Agolo. Benin's Angelica Kijo with Agolo.
Well, in Ghana, the Ministry of Education says almost 45% of primary school teachers and 30% of junior high school teachers have not been formally trained. But with the help from international donors, the country's authorities have launched a two-way interactive distance teacher training program that aims to train up to 5,000 teachers within 2 years. VOA's George Pudik reports.
In many schools in rural Ghana, there are no computers, TVs, or smartphones. So during recess, girls amuse themselves with games while boys play soccer. In class, teachers talk while students listen, trying to understand and remember. There's very little engagement and virtually no interaction because many teachers themselves were not trained to do it. The private non-profit Varki Foundation, together with co-donor Dubai Cares and the Ghanaian Ministry of Education, wants to change that. Varki CEO Vika Spoda spoke to VOA via Skype.
What we're trying to do is leapfrog what they should have received when they first became teachers to providing the latest and most cutting-edge classroom pedagogy that is available.
With the help of a $2 million grant from Dubai Cares, 40 schools have been equipped with a satellite dish, a solar-powered computer, a projector, and a modern electronic blackboard, as well as a trained instructor called a facilitator. During a two-hour interactive training session conducted every other week live from a TV studio in Accra, two instructional leaders, together with facilitators at the site, engage head teachers and deputy head teachers in two-way training. It is a trickle-down program in which head teachers pass the instructions to other teachers on how to teach the students.
The teachers then come back every 2 weeks into our classrooms, which have the satellite hubs, with the questions that have been raised by their teachers. And that peer-to-peer learning that happens is a fairly powerful way of improving your understanding and your skills base.
In 17 sessions, with 3 to 5 schools at a time, the instructional leaders will train approximately 5,000 teachers over a 2-year period. Educators say the students are already seeing benefits from their teachers' training.
They have gained interest more in going to school because now teaching has become interested. It has become actively based, unlike first when the teacher will rattle and then leave.
Students also say they are now enjoying classes.
The teachers will give you a marker to go to the board, and whatever will come into your mind, then you write it. So after the writing, you will see many funny things, so it makes us laugh.
The Varki Foundation says at the end of the pilot program, an independent agency will evaluate the outcome and suggest ways to improve the process. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
In Kenya, roughly 11% of the population earns enough to make monthly mortgage payments. However, that may be changing as starter homes are taking the housing market by storm. Priced at $10,000, one can buy a one-bedroom apartment in Kenya. And new apartment units on the outskirts of Nairobi are sold out before the start of construction. Lenny Ruvaga reports on Kenya's housing market from Nairobi.
Anthony Wamburu takes a look at a sample apartment in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Today, the 35-year-old technology enthusiast is in the market for his first property. Wamburu says he has been saving for a while now and hopes to buy the apartment valued at $50,000 as his first home. The units are dubbed starter homes by Suraya Properties, the firm behind the venture. Wamburu says the homes offer value for his hard-earned cash.
They're not very expensive for somebody like me who's looking at having a family quite soon. And also, I like the way it comes with different benefits. It comes with a gym. It also comes with a swimming pool. So I would not have to get a gym membership somewhere else. So that home would be quite perfect for me.
Begun 10 years ago, Suraya Properties has built starter homes in the Kenyan capital and its outskirts with a view towards tapping into the low and middle income market. Most of their units range between $10,000 and $80,000. CEO Peter Moriah says the company was started to supply affordable homes to first-time home buyers, but found a market he had not anticipated.
But surprisingly, we have found that there's a lot of people heading towards retirement who have looked at it differently, and they're thinking we are going to go maybe to their countryside retirement home, but they want a place in town where they can be coming and where it's their own.
The new apartment complexes in Thika and Siokimau are still under construction, but are completely sold out. Still, home ownership remains beyond the reach of most Kenyans. The mortgage company, a Kenyan real estate firm, estimates that only a fifth of Kenyans can afford a home priced at $10,000. Part of the problem is the high interest rates charged by Kenyan banks. Economic analyst Ali Ken Satchu.
You're talking about borrowing at 18, 19, 20, in some cases even higher than that. It's very expensive to borrow money from the bank. And until we see significantly lower rates, I think we'll continue to see very poor mortgage penetration because it's just too expensive.
Another real estate company, Has Consult, says only 30,000 Kenyans hold mortgages, a tiny fraction of the country's 42 million people. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States condemns the Boko Haram terrorist attacks on January 29th and 30th in northeast Nigeria. On January 30th, in the village of Dolori, the terrorist bombed a market, attacked a village, and firebombed huts. Boko Haram militants set fire to as many as 300 homes in the village, burning alive some people who were inside, including children. According to Nigeria's National Emergency Management Agency, at least 65 people were killed and 136 injured. Boko Haram, which in March 2015 pledged its allegiance to the Islamic State, has been attacking northern Nigeria for years. According to press reports, Boko Haram's insurgency has killed 20,000 people in the last 6 years and driven at least 2.3 million from their homes. Boko Haram continues to commit vicious attacks against the innocent, including children. This terrorist organization repeatedly has shown no regard for human life. We extend our deepest condolences to the families of the latest victims of Boko Haram. The United States will continue to support those affected by Boko Haram's violence through ongoing humanitarian aid and support services. In response to the threat posed by Boko Haram, President Barack Obama announced in October 2015 that the United States would send 300 U.S. troops, along with surveillance drones, to Cameroon to bolster a West African effort to counter the militant Islamist group. U.S. troops were tasked with conducting airborne intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance operations in the region. In a statement issued on February 2nd, State Department spokesperson John Kirby said the United States remains committed to supporting Nigeria and its Lake Chad Basin partners in the fight against terrorism.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
Next on Let's Talk, rumors. Millions are paid to athletes, singers, and actors for their work. Celebrities, do they earn too much money? Join host Sandy Shomari and his guests discussing rumors. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African Music Mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.